Graduate medical institutions in the United States have increasingly adopted competency-based frameworks that govern the progression of residents and fellows, but billing rules for trainees haven't evolved in parallel with those changes. I'm Stephen Morrissey, managing editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, and I'm talking with Abbas Hassan, a plastic surgery resident at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Dr. Hassan has co-authored a perspective article about competency-based billing for medical trainees. Dr. Hassan, under competency-based frameworks, how are trainees evaluated and how do their responsibilities change over time?
So over time, GME has moved away from purely a time-based model where you complete a set number of years and you're presumed ready and toward a more competency-based framework. And that means that there are defined milestones and trainees are expected to demonstrate specific skills and judgment before they're entrusted with more autonomy. So supervision is part of that. The structure that most clinicians recognize is the progression from direct supervision, where the teaching physician is present, to indirect supervision, where the teaching physician is immediately available, but not necessarily in the room. And really, attendings cannot physically be everywhere at once. And trainees, especially senior trainees, are delivering substantial amounts of care with appropriate oversight.
How widely have those approaches been implemented in GME programs in the United States?
I would say quite widely. And really, I just wanted to paint the scene here with an example. So picture a night in the hospital. It's 2 a.m. A senior resident is in the emergency room repairing a laceration. Now, this isn't their first time. They've done it hundreds of times, and they know exactly what to look for if things go sideways. And they, by every clinical definition, competent. Now imagine the supervising attending is not in the room when this happens. And maybe they're handling a crashing patient somewhere, and maybe they're just not available immediately by the bedside. So although the care still happened and the patient still got treated under the billing rules that Medicare currently set up, specifically the Medicare teaching physician rules, that procedure effectively is worth $0 to the teaching hospitals. So we argue in this perspective that medical education has shifted to a competency-based training model with graduated autonomy, but the billing rules have not really kept pace. And that results in a system that can inadvertently penalize competence because as trainees again advance to that indirect supervision, more of their clinical work becomes difficult or even impossible to bill.
So under current rules, when can teaching hospitals be reimbursed for services provided by trainees?
So under Medicare Part B, a teaching physician must be physically present during the key or critical portions of a service for it to be billed. Now, the concept was designed with the goal of preventing inappropriate billing, to avoid duplicate payment, to make sure that teaching physicians are meaningfully involved in the care. Now, the problem is that these rules are not aligned with how graded autonomy is supposed to work today. So one issue is that Medicare effectively leaves the definition of the quote-unquote key or critical portions to the teaching physician's professional judgment. Now, that sounds flexible, but in practice, it shifts the risks of audits into clinicians' institutions. So a lot of academic medical centers responded predictably. They actually adopt conservative measures, and they simply don't bill for many services performed under indirect supervision, even when that supervision is clinically appropriate. So we're seeing that the net effect is that as trainees progress and do more under indirect supervision, more of their clinical work becomes uncompensated.
So as you say, these rules apply to Medicare Part B. What policies do teaching hospitals use for care billed to private payers?
Yeah, that's a great point. So Medicare contributes heavily to graduate medical education or GME funding. They pay hospitals to train doctors, but unfortunately, private insurance generally do not contribute to GME. So if a resident treats a patient with the private insurance and their indirect supervision, and the hospital does not bill for it because of these strict rules, which hospitals often apply to all payers, then the private insurer benefits twice. They get a well-trained doctor pipeline without paying for the training, and also they get the actual patient care for free. So it's really a double subsidy for them.
So what's known about the value of the care provided by trainees, including the value of this unbilled care?
So there are over 180,000 residents and fellows in the U.S., and they provide a massive amount of care, particularly in safety-knit hospitals, trauma center, and high-acuity patients. So if you go to a major academic center at 3 a.m., the person saving your life is very likely to be a resident. So trainees are economic assets, and studies have shown that resident labor is incredibly cost-effective compared to other staffing models. And there was a case where a residency program closed, and the hospital had to hire dozens of advanced practice providers, so nurse practitioners or physician assistants, to cover the workload. And their costs skyrocketed. So, yet because of these billing rules, there is a wide gap between the value of the care these residents deliver and the revenue the hospital can actually capture. And there was also another study involving neurosurgery residents, and they tracked the billable value of just one junior resident on call. And it was estimated that the billing value of that work is over $340,000 a year. Now, that's only for one person. Another review looked at plastic surgery consults and found that the vast majority were done, over 80% were done under indirect supervision. And because of these billing rules again, the service line lost out on hundreds of thousands of dollars in revenue. And remember, this isn't just Medicare money. Many hospitals apply these strict rules to private insurers too, just to keep things simple and compliant. And that means, again, private insurance companies are often getting a free ride on resident labor.
Finally, in your article, you propose a framework that you say could better align reimbursement with the value of the care that trainees provide. What would that framework look like, and how could it protect both patient safety and educational integrity?
In order to understand the framework, we bring up a couple of pre-existing elements that we think we can rearrange to finally come up with this framework. The main proof of concept that we discuss is the primary care exception. Now, it is a specific Medicare rule that allows residents in primary care clinics to see patients for lower-level visits, and the attending can bill for it without being in the exam room as long as they're immediately available. Now, it's been around for a very long time, and it works. It really proves to us that you can have billing without physical presence if you have the right guardrails. Then there's what happened during the COVID-19 pandemic. So Medicare at that time allowed attendings to supervise via audio and video to protect everyone from exposure, and it also worked. Now, after the pandemic, they kept a lot of flexibility for rural training programs, but they cut it for many urban ones. So we call this the GME digital divide. So if telesupervision is safe in a rural clinic, why is it unsafe in a city hospital? Now, if a resident is doing consults at 3 a.m., having the attending join the high-definition video to review the exam might actually be better and faster, more efficient than waiting for them to drive in. So the proposed framework that we put in this perspective is a three-part framework. And the first pillar is that we think billing should be tied to competency, so not just physical presence. So Medicare already has a proof of concept, like we talked about, the primary care exception. But we can extend that logic more broadly. So for licensed senior residents and fellows who have verified competencies, there are certain defined services that could be billed under direct supervision, as long as we have clear documentations. And we can also make specialty-specific scope of practice lists, basically a transparent menu of what a verified competent senior trainee can do without the attending being immediately available for escalation. For the second pillar, we argue that financing should be fair. Right now, private insurers often benefit from trainee-delivered care and from the physician workforce pipeline, but they do not reliably support GME. So an all-payer contribution mechanism through state or maybe national GME funds would really address that free rider problem. And finally, the third pillar, we need to modernize what supervision looks like. We're asking CMS to allow technology-enabled oversight via secure real-time audio video to satisfy the presence requirement across teaching settings, not just rural ones. And that matters most for after hours when an attending cannot immediately join in person, but can join via audio or video to review the key findings and guide care without unnecessary delays.
Thank you, Dr. Hassan.